This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Anna Quindlen is our guest today on the program. She joins us to talk about writing and her new novel, Blessings. The author of four novels, Quindlen is also a columnist for Newsweek magazine. She writes the back page column. Her column appears on the back page every other week. Quindlen, who won a Pulitzer Prize in 1992, says she took her first job as a reporter to pay the rent. But it gave her so much more. Her stint in the newsroom helped her develop an ear for the way people talk. In addition to Blessings, Anna Quindlen is the author of the novels Object Lessons, One True Thing, and Black and Blue. She's also the author of four nonfiction books and two children's books. Her new novel takes place in a small community on a country estate known as Blessings. The story opens with a teenage couple driving up to the estate and leaving behind their newborn daughter. The couple think the beauty of the place will mean a good life for the child. The baby is found by the estate caretaker, Skip, who decides he'll keep her. But it isn't long before 80-year-old Lydia Blessings, the matriarch of Blessings, discovers the baby. Listeners, we're having a little difficulty this afternoon with our phone line. I do want you to call in with questions for our guest, Anna Quindlen, this afternoon. But what will happen is, instead of putting you on the air, we'll get your question, and then I will relay it to our guest, Anna Quindlen. The number to call with your questions, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And Jason Croft in Master Control will transcribe your question, and then he'll bring it into the studio to me, and then I will relay it to Anna. It's a little different than the way we usually do it, but we're in a pinch here this afternoon, and I hope you'll understand. Thanks for understanding. Anna Quindlen, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us this
afternoon.
Thank
you, and thanks for making that accommodation with your phone line.
Oh, not a problem at all. You know, there was just it was one of these things where on your schedule it turned up not quite accurately.
Well, that, you know, the thing about book tour is that if one domino falls awry,
yeah,
all the dominoes behind are in trouble.
Well, I don't think we're really in trouble. I think this is just going to work out just fine. So, anyway, I'm glad you're with us this
afternoon.
Thank you. Last month, you wrote a piece for the Writers on Writing column in the New York Times. That's where I got that little factoid about how you took your first job as a reporter to pay the rent. You know, you point out that writers must have a feel for the way people talk. Did you know that when you took that first job as a reporter?
Oh, no. I took my first job as a reporter when I was still in college. It's a miracle to me that I could actually tie my shoes. I was so inexperienced at every level. And I just stayed on as a reporter because I loved the work so much. I loved going to places I would never have gone otherwise and meeting people I would never have met otherwise. And I think it probably wasn't until I started working on my first novel, Object Lessons, that I suddenly realized what a great gift it had been in a number of ways, but particularly in terms of understanding how highly individualized syntax was in terms of the way people spoke and how you could really capture a human being just by getting that down.
Hmm. What were the first stories you covered as a reporter?
Oh, you know, I tended to cover small human interest stories more than anything else. My first story for the New York Times was a story about Valentine's Day. I still remember it very well because the beginning of it was about one of those eternal triangles, albeit one in a kindergarten classroom, you know. Matthew loved Jennifer, but Jennifer loved Christopher, one of those. And actually, you know, those were beginners sort of assignments, but the truth is I never really wanted to stray far from them. You know, other of my colleagues wanted to cover the White House or the State House, and I always just wanted to go to some ordinary person's house.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the drama in settings like classrooms and police stations and City Hall in the back rooms, that's where you find really great stories.
Well, yeah, and also so much of the rest, covering people who are used to being covered it's all set to music. There's not a whole lot of spontaneity or real human drama in it. Covering people in their daily lives and when either when those lives touch news events or simply when people are going about the business of living, that's where you really find the unexpected and the unscripted.
Mm. And the rest, as you say, is so often piped.
Well, yeah, but that's really a terrible term of negativity in the news business, because it means actually making stuff up, which happens from time to time, that sort of anonymous quote that sounds just too perfect, because it is.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if it is a fact of life and political life that things, this is pretty cynical, I guess, but things do sound so piped. We're in election season now, and you watch, you see the spots on television or hear them on the radio. It sounds pretty piped.
You know, it's so odd when you're covering a big race, because I can remember times when I was covering presidential races when I would think the candidate gave a great speech with some really important point. I'd say, wow, the stuff about health care, and the other guys would look at me sort of pityingly and go, oh, yeah, the line about people above profits, yeah, that's from the stump speech. Yeah, he uses that at every stop. And you sort of feel like, oh, no.
On the other hand, you can't have a new speech every day, can you, or can you?
No, you can't. And also, the truth is sometimes there are only a few answers to the same question, as I now appreciate keenly, having talked about my work and my book all over the country, as you do on book tour. I mean, I suppose sometimes you can switch or change or come up with something new for the sake of coming up with something new, but sometimes there just is a certain answer to a certain question.
Hmm. Well, here's a predictable question. What inspired Blessings?
That's one where I wish I could come up with a predictable answer. The theme that I was interested in exploring was the theme of redemption. I was very interested in having a character who was an older person, because I think from my time as a reporter particularly, they bring so much to the table in terms of perspective and history that I knew that would be an interesting exercise in character development. And because I've written some really negative male characters in my novels in the past, I wanted to have a protagonist who was both male, which I thought would be a challenge for me, and a fabulous guy, which was by way of being my own redemption. And that's the genesis of Skip.
Hmm. Yeah, well, Skip is a really interesting character. And then also, here we have this story of an infant left on a doorstep. And, whether it's a country estate or a church or a front porch with a light on, that story really moves us.
Well, I guess it does. I have to be honest with you. I didn't think of it as an archetype as I was doing it. It just seemed to me to be a real and predictable situation. Then, of course, when I was done, I considered everybody from Moses and the bulrushes to the well-known case at the University of Delaware of the couple who had the baby and then disposed of it. And it occurred to me that it was archetypical, but it just has always seemed to me that children change everything, and that was another thing I wanted to explore.
Yeah. Well, how does Skip Cuddy, this caretaker, become so attached to the baby left at Blessings? What happens to him?
Oh, I think he's a guy who's been looking his whole life, all 24 years of it, for someone to really attach to. For a variety of reasons, that hasn't happened with his parents. And it's happened with his friends despite himself, because they're a pretty mixed bunch. But, I think he's one of those people who's always been looking for a focus for his life, and suddenly overnight he finds it.
Mm. Maybe you would, do you have the book with you?
Yeah,
I do. Maybe you'd read an excerpt from the book, the scene where Skip is wondering himself why he wants this baby, why he wants to keep her.
He could not have said when it was exactly that he decided to keep her, or why. It made no sense. He'd never thought much about having children, and having one now would cause considerable trouble, as he'd already learned. But he knew that there were things that seemed lunatic to the world that you decided to do anyhow. That was what his father must have felt, working as a long-distance trucker, seeing less and less of his son, meeting a woman who was waiting tables at the restaurant in the Quality Inn near Tampa, finding out once again how it felt to roll over in bed and find the sheets no longer cold, deciding to stay in Florida, although he had a house and a son 1,000 miles north. Or maybe it was a damn dog he kept thinking about. Over the years, whenever they'd passed a farm in his uncle's truck, he'd stared out the window at the barns and the fields and the long gravel drives and looked for an old beagle basking in the sun. He just wished there'd been something permanent about his life, something he could look at or hold or keep in his dresser drawer that spoke of years of cereal breakfast, after-school milk, homework at the kitchen table, family trips to the county fair, or just those moments before sleep when the ceiling of your room was as familiar as your face in the mirror. There was no premium in it for him. He was certain there'd be trouble if anyone found out, and he was certain that sooner or later Mrs. Blessing or Nadine or someone would hear a noise in the night or see the dome of the head peeking from the neck of his shirt. But a couple of days in, he'd realize that no matter how often and how haphazardly he put his index finger in her creased little palm, she would surround it with her fingers like a greeting. "Your baby will hold tight to your hand," the book burbled, and without realizing it, he'd fixed on that one word, the word "your." Or maybe it wasn't that at all. Maybe it was when he was raking out the old branches underneath the stand of birch trees along the fence that bordered Rolling Hills Road and was surprised by a small sound like the one the deer made when they were startled and realized that she had sneezed. "Bless you," he murmured. And when he knocked off at the end of the day, he looked up colds in the book's index. Maybe he didn't really have a choice, like so many people who wound up with children haphazardly, accidentally. When he thought of what else he could do, he could imagine only various cold and cruelly lit rooms that smelled of disinfectant. The hospital in Mount Mason, where he'd had his legs set when he was 14, and his burns treated when the deep fat fryer at Burger King spit back at his scrawny bicep just after closing one night, leaving a magenta blot. The police station that looked like an elementary school and smelled like one too, Lysol and fried food and cigarettes, where he'd sat on a bench with his hands cuffed behind him after the robbery. The courthouse that had been refurbished in the 60s, so that it was still a grand limestone hulk, but inside a maze of particle board paneling and checkerboard linoleum and gray metal desks. He wasn't taking anybody to any of those places of impermanence and phony concern. He might as well drop this baby down a well and listen for the splash. He knew those people. They'd piss away a couple of years passing around paper looking for a mother who just wanted to be left in peace. The little girl would be 3 years old and still living in some lousy foster home with people who spent the money the state sent on Camel lights and a satellite dish. He bought some disposable cameras and he took her picture, sleeping, waking, even screaming. Her angry maroon color had faded by the beginning of the second week to an almost ghostly white with a faint mottling of pink, like the flowers on the magnolia trees along the drive. Her umbilical cord fell off, scaring the hell out of him until he saw the small, neat navel in its place, and he took the barrette that had been clipped to the cord and the cardboard box and the flannel shirt and put them all together on the top shelf of the closet in the back room. He put the cameras next to them. He was constructing a history for her, the way he wished someone had constructed one for him. And as though she knew all this, on the 10th day she rested. He lined the bottles up in the refrigerator, put her down, and fell asleep himself, expecting to wake to crying in an hour or two. And instead she slept until 3, woke and ate, went back to sleep, complained just before dawn, drank down a bottle, scarcely waking, and went back to sleep again, her small mouth pursed, her fingers splayed, until around 9 o'clock. So he had time to go up the basement steps, make the coffee for Mrs. Blessing, clear fallen branches from the drive, and water the vegetables and the zinnias before she woke, demanding more. In the afternoon, he rode the tractor far from the house and took her from the sling to lay her on a towel beneath leggy elm trees waving in the wind. A breeze blew, and her eyes widened, and he swore that she smiled vacantly at the sky. The book said that she wouldn't smile for weeks, but he knew what he'd seen. "Whoa," he said, kneeling beside her. Solemnly, she blinked, closed her eyes, and tightened her fist around his finger. As far as Skip was concerned, that was that. She was his.
Mm. Anna Quinlan reading from her new novel, Blessings. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. Give us a call, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. When Jason in Master Control picks up the phone with your call this afternoon, he'll take your question and he'll bring it to me in the studio, and I will relay it to Anna Quinlan because we've got a minor glitch here this afternoon as far as the phones go. So anyway, I do invite your questions, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Anna, when Skip was coming to life on the page, were you ever surprised at his tenacity and the tenderness that he shows?
I'm not sure I was surprised by them, but I was kind of awestruck by them. I mean, there's a certain kind of person that I've met over the years who has a kind of a gift for unconditional love,
mm-hmm.
and I think he sort of, before his very eyes, becomes one of those people. They're few and far between, and they're very, very special.
Do you think that his remembrances of childhood affect him in terms of what he wants and what he's capable of?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of what this novel is about the ways in which we're shaped, sometimes without even realizing it, frequently realizing it, but not even being able to do anything about it. By our past lives. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Lydia Blessing, age 80, is such a valuable character for me. Her mind lives half of the time, at least sometimes more than that, in the past, going over the past again and again, and yet repeating in some ways the patterns that were set by the past and which it would be better for her to override, and which, because of this child, and Skip, she does find a way to get past.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, as you write very early in the novel about Lydia Blessings, you write, the only way she could remember the child she had once been was to look at photo albums.
Right.
And even then, she seemed strange to herself. She was occasionally incredulous, not about the fact that she had gotten old, but about the notion that she had ever been young.
That's right. That's really who she is. She's become mired in this sense of herself that really begins for her at the time of her first child, and sort of freezes her in a kind of aspect of experience and memory.
Hmm. Now she eventually, I mean, it's very difficult to keep a baby a secret on an estate where the handyman, the caretaker, is taking care of her, and eventually she does discover the caretaker is caring for this little baby girl. She goes along with Skip. Why does she want to keep the child?
Well, I'm not sure that she really wants to keep the child so much as I think she, too, is taken by and charmed by his devotion to the baby. Her own baby had not had a father. The man that she had married was killed very early on in World War II. And Mrs. Blessing, whatever the opposite of having a gift for unconditional love is, that's what she has. She puts conditions on everything. And love is very difficult for her. I mean, there's a really painful moment in the novel when she's had a great epiphany about her life and her grievances over her life, when she, on an impulse, calls her own daughter, and she wants to say something hugely important and transforming to her daughter, and instead she just winds up asking her how her flowers are doing. At the last moment, she balks emotionally and goes back to the tried and true small talk that's been the currency of that relationship. So I think she is so taken by how Skip proceeds, and also by his determination that this is how things are going to be, that she initially goes along with it, and then in the way that so many of us are almost without meaning to, she's charmed by the baby.
And the baby calls up some feelings that I would say had lain dormant for a long time in Lydia Blessing.
That's right. They do, just by showing up, so much speak of possibility and of the vast number of choices and lives that are available to each of us, and that all seem immensely possible when you're looking at a small infant. I mean, you do tend to project yourself onto them sometimes because, of course, at that point, you really have no idea about character or intelligence or drive or any of the things that make for what passes for success in this world. Mm-hmm. And so I think that looking at this child makes her realize that there was a time of great possibility for her, and that time is over.
Of these three characters, we haven't really talked about the baby too much, but in terms of Lydia and Skip, Charles Cuddy, was one more challenging to write than the other?
Well, I mean, the challenge with Lydia, and I suppose by reader reaction, I would have to conclude that I've overcome it, is that I found her quite unlikable during a lot of the writing of the book, and I was concerned that the reader would wonder why they were going to throw in their lot for 60,000 or 70,000 words with this person they didn't care for very much. But in fact, readers seem to really like her. There's something about her indomitability.
Yeah, she's okay.
That speaks to people. Skip was much more difficult for me because I've never written from the point of view of a male protagonist before. And that was a challenge. I just had to keep working to keep his role in the book strong and realistic.
Also, childhood obviously plays a big role here. We've got childhood memories on the part of Skip and on the part of Lydia. Does your childhood feel close at hand? Is it something that you can easily draw on, or do your kids help you pull on that, or how does that feel to you now as a writer, your distance from childhood?
Parts of my childhood just seem incredibly powerful and vivid. I mean, summer just catapults me back into a different world, just smelling it and feeling the heat and seeing the kids who are not in school just takes me right back. But I mean, one of the great beauties of having children, and there are too many of them sometimes for me to count, is that you get to re-experience all kinds of seminal events, and you get to do it at a time when you're smart enough to understand that they are seminal. So, everything from, rainbows, sunsets, shooting stars, all that stuff, to, heartbreak and disappointment and homesickness, you get to see sort of secondhand. And I mean, as a human being, I consider it a great gift. As a novelist, it's priceless.
Also, I think you've done something here that's really good in terms of reminding us of the little and not so little tensions between generations.
Well, that's true. And those tensions in some ways are more marked among women at the end of the 20th century in America, because the mores, the standard operating procedure, has changed so radically almost overnight from one generation to another. And you see that with Lydia, that that she felt obliged to live a certain way under a certain set of rules and to behave in certain ways, some of which were very detrimental to her personally, because of societal mores that have now been completely thrown out the window. And there's a kind of a resentment almost on her part about that. And then there's the sort of requisite resentment between her and her daughter, the kind of scratchiness of two strong personalities separated by 20 years rubbing against each other.
Yeah. And the older generation, I think, is much more likely to hang on to that stuff and keep secrets. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, but I mean, they grew up with the notion that that was the proper thing to do. And the truth is, although we've embraced the total honesty precept, you know, it may be that we're in a synthesis moment now, that the thesis was this novel, this idea that you should behave a certain way and keep your mouth shut. The antithesis was letting it all hang out in a way which is not always entirely attractive or useful.
Yeah.
And maybe we're reaching a synthesis where the two generations can reach some sort of emotional middle ground.
Mm. You know, let's go back to the idea of the importance of knowing how people talk and what's important to them. In Blessings, the people feel real because of that. And not only do they speak in a genuine way, but when I'm reading what they don't say out loud, that's in keeping with their character as well.
Exactly.
Hearing their voices, does it also allow you to hear their thoughts as a writer when you're writing?
Actually, I think once you get a character's speaking voice down, if you write a couple of lines of dialogue and there is that idiosyncratic way of expressing yourself or not expressing yourself, of being very interior, once you get that down, you're about at least halfway and maybe more of the way there towards a character. There's something about just having someone's voice in hand that makes so much of the rest follow.
Maybe you would give us an idea, a sense of Lydia's voice by reading a passage.
Well, there is
from
this,
her point of view.
This great moment when she first meets Skip. She picks Skip up in the parking lot of the Walmart because her battery runs down. She doesn't take care of her car because it would cost money, and she's cheap, as the novel says, in the way that rich people are often cheap about small things. And then she has him follow her home in his truck after he's charged her battery. She couldn't say why, except that she thought he was too dim to be duplicitous. But she'd had him follow her home along the roads that left Mount Mason for the mountains. "What is your name?" she had said, seating him at the table in the kitchen as Nadine cleaned vegetables at the sink, making a good deal of noise, as though she were playing a concerto of disapproval written for colander, knives, pan lids, and faucet. "Skip," he said. "Cuddy," as though his last name were an afterthought. "Skip is not a name for a person. Skip is a dog's name. Skippy. I knew a boy named Quad once." "What? Quad. What? You deaf?" shouted Nadine. "Mind your own business," Mrs. Blessing called over the noise from the sink. "I'm sorry, I thought you said Quad," Skip had said, pushing his hair back and fidgeting in his chair. "I did. Quad Preston. Leland Preston the Fourth. Quad. Because of the Fourth. I refuse to call him Quad. I don't care for most nicknames. What is your real name?" I mean, that sense of her as somebody who will peremptorily say, you know, Skip is a dog's name, without any notion that might be offensive, because, of course, she is telling the truth. It sort of captures her for me.
Yeah. And these three characters, Nadine included here in this scene, I like the way that they're honest characters, and I think that's why people, your readers, are willing to go along with Lydia Blessings, even though she has this prickly side.
Well,
you know?
Maybe that's it. I mean, the other possibility is, you know, you get too close to the action to figure out what really works and what doesn't. I mean, that's part of the problem. I remember when I finished Black and Blue, the novel that I wrote before this, my editor said to me when she had the first draft, you know, not much needs to be done, but I've suggested a number of changes that you could do, that you could make to really heighten the incredible suspense and make it build more effectively to that incredibly explosive chapter at the end. And I said, oh. And my editor, who's very good at reading me, said, you do understand how suspenseful this book is, don't you? And I said, actually, no, I hadn't really thought of it. Because, of course, I knew what was going to happen every step of the way, so I was not in the least in suspense. And I think sometimes when you're in the midst of this, it's like being in the midst of a family. You know, it takes you decades before you can look back on your family dynamic and say, oh, that's why he did that, and that's why I responded that way, and that's how our parents saw us, that kind of thing. And it's somewhat the same thing with a novel. You're right in the middle of it, and you can't really see it clear until you're well out of it or until readers see it clear for you and tell you what you really did.
Mm. Well, as a reader, sometimes I feel just totally immersed in the story, and then when I put it down, then I start to think about it. And then also because of the job that I have, I admire when something is well done, you know, the craft and the art that is within the covers of the book really come roaring out at me. I'm thinking, for example, of all the little nuances that are here in the book. In addition to the generational differences, there are big differences of class, which
Right.
we've kind of touched on here. And sometimes they're subtle and sometimes not.
Well, it's a subject that I'm intensely interested in because I think Americans continue to hold to this line that America is basically a classless society. And while the membrane of class in America is much more permeable than it is in almost any other country on the face of the earth, the truth is that there's still very much class barriers in America, and in small towns you see it in where people live and what kind of jobs they have and whether they go to college or not and who they hang out with and who they marry and all that. And it's very, very vivid to me, and I really wanted to explore it in this book.
Yeah. I just want to share a paragraph with our listeners this afternoon that kind of gets at just what Ann and I have been talking about. Lydia's father on his son, Lydia's brother, Sonny, because they had wealth, they were able to do things. They were able to build on the estate during the Great Depression. And this is a paragraph from fairly early on in the novel. The people in Mount Mason had been glad of the work, and the barn had gone up fast, the wall supports and roof struts laid out flat in the middle of the big grass gully next to the swamp that Edwin Blessing had decided upon for its site. He had also decided that Sonny should work on the barn with the hired laborers from town. Make a man of him, Mr. Blessing kept saying, as though even character could be contracted out. Teach him the value of hard work. Sonny had been 13 years old that summer. Make a man of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the way he always talks. He sort of talks in those sort of empty, useless aphorisms that frequently pass for conversation in polite circles.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we say things like that when we don't know what else to say.
Right.
And it's really telling about an issue like class,
right.
I think. Yeah. In the piece that you did for the New York Times, Writers on Writing, you talked about keeping a reporter's notebook always with you. Do details come to you throughout the day and you pencil them in throughout the day?
They do. I'm not working on a novel right now. Thank you, God. Not until January. But even for the column, things will sort of cross my mental screen. And since, unfortunately, I can no longer count on my memory, I tend to jot them down now if there's an idea that I'm considering for a column or just some small things that I want to keep current in my brain pan.
When you write a column, when you start to think about what you want to, what topic you want to address, the subject you want to address, and then you sit down to write it, does the writing of this column ever affect your feelings about an issue? Either makes you feel, I don't know, do you ever change your opinion, for example, after writing a piece, sitting down and working on it?
I don't usually change my opinion, but I usually deepen and sometimes change my thinking. There's a famous quote from Scotty Reston, who for many years ran the New York Times and was a columnist there. How can I know what I think until I read what I write? Mm. And I think that all the time when I'm doing a column. I start blithely to type my version of events and my opinions thereof. Mm. And suddenly I think, this is too glib, this doesn't go deep enough, this is predictable. And the next thing you know, I'm sort of taking the idea this way and that, until finally, hopefully, I wind up with something that's more original and that goes more deeply into my own thoughts. And I think that's a change. It's not a change in the essential nature of my opinion. You know, I don't ever start to write a column on capital punishment and suddenly go, "Eureka! It really is a good idea." But it does sometimes change the ways in which not only I look at the subject, but the ways in which I bring the subject to the reader.
Mm. It's really been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks for a really nice read. Blessings. Good read. Thank you very much.
And, thank you.
And enjoy your time off, but we hope that another novel won't be too far
January,
off.
January.
Okay.
I'm giving myself a little mini vacation.
Okay. Take care again. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Anna Quinlan has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Her new novel, Blessings. She is the author of four novels. She's also a columnist for Newsweek magazine. She writes the back page column. Her column appears on the back page every other week.